From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to ARRL's The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
One of the first things most hams learn when they get their license and start building things is how to solder. That doesn't necessarily come easily to a lot of people, and unsoldering doesn't come even easier to a lot of people. I've been burned many a times, figuratively and literally.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yes. But I thought it would make a good topic for us to talk about, especially you. I mean, you've been soldering since I was a baby, probably.
Probably so, yes. That's true. Maybe before. Yeah, soldering is a good method of providing a reliable, long-lasting connection between two conductors, particularly if they're copper. And that's a key point. And they can be wire, copper wire terminals or connectors. And they can be tinned copper, which is copper that has a thin layer of solder applied already. Some metals are not particularly well suited for regular soldering, including aluminum and stainless steel, although there are special techniques and special solders that can be used. But by and large, copper wire is what we're talking about, or copper connections. It's a key process for electronic assembly, but it's important to note it's not the only connection technique. In many applications now, people are using crimping connections, particularly coax connectors, some other kinds of connectors,
yes.
And that has taken over a large fraction of connector assembly.
I was surprised to find that. I've been accustomed to soldering my coax connectors for as long as I can remember, but now I see a lot of people crimping instead.
I'm with you on that, and I think one of the reasons, there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that the coax cable has changed somewhat. We now have coax cable with the foam dielectric that is much more likely to be damaged during soldering because of the heat. It doesn't hold up with the heat well. We have shields that are not just copper braid but have foil, and that works much better with crimping than you can't solder to aluminum foil in any event. Some have both, and you can solder to the copper and hope that everything connects up somewhere in the cable, which I think generally works. Also, ring terminals are good for heavy connections like power connections, that sort of thing, connections to batteries. And they're held together with nuts and machine screws, and that may be much easier than soldering to a chassis, for example, to tie something to a chassis with a ring connector and hardware. Now, traditional electronic solder that we use in the U.S. for most electronic work is usually 40% lead and 60% tin. It's formed into a thin, soft wire with a core of rosin flux. And the solder is supplied in a roll with different thicknesses available from different manufacturers. And I guess I have a strong preference for the very thin solder.
Me too.
And every now and then you'd say, gee, this great big thing I'm doing would be better with something thicker. But the thin solder will always work. The thick solder doesn't work for tight and tight places where you end up with more solder than you want, and it goes all over the place and shorts everything out. So I like the thin stuff. Such solder melts between a temperature of 361 and 374 degrees Fahrenheit, it says someplace. But be aware that in many countries now, lead-free solder is required for all consumer electronics, and that tends to require up to 100 degrees higher temperature. We won't get into details about that, but be aware of that because that's something you may have to deal with, because manufacturers who sell equipment to multiple countries, which is most manufacturers,
yes,
have to meet the requirements of all the countries they sell them. And then they'd rather have one device that they sell everywhere than a special device for the U.S. that uses one kind of solder and a device for the U.K. that uses another. So you're likely to encounter that kind of solder. Just be aware of that. Soldering irons are often rated in terms of the watts, the power that they consume as they come up to temperature, and usually in watts. And that's not a precise measure of the heat transfer capability, but it does provide an indication of the amount of heat available to bring the work up to temperature. In the early days of my soldering, back when radios were just coming out, we had pretty big, hefty soldering guns, 140-watt 100 and 140 watt, usually two heat irons. And some of them were quite a bit bigger. They were called instant heat soldering guns, and that was kind of an exaggeration. But in comparison to the old soldering copper that took 15 minutes to come to temperature, it was pretty quick. The large instant heat soldering gun from 60 years ago is just as useful today as it was back then for the same kinds of things, which would be connecting discrete components to terminals, connecting vacuum tube socket pins to wires, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, sweating a wire to a copper chassis, or even coax connectors are very good with that kind of thing, or the larger ones. So big connections like power connections and antenna connections, outdoor things that tend to get cool with the breeze require more heat. But most things now, most of our soldering is on printed circuit boards, very small components, and such a soldering iron is a very bad thing. You do not want to use it for that because it's...
You mean I can't use it on a microprocessor, for example?
You could, but it probably will not process afterwards. The problems are the following, that the microprocessor or any of these other components have pins that are very close together. Mm. And if the soldering gun tip touches one pin, it's also going to touch two more, yeah. and the solder will flow between them, so everything gets shorted out. In addition, the heat is high enough so that the component may be damaged, printed circuit board itself may be damaged or burned, the foil can curl right up and come off the printed circuit board. I've done all these things.
Yes, me too.
Yep, so I've gotten a soldering station instead that has an adjustable heat level, and I can set it to whatever temperature I want. Now, there are two types of those. The one I have is the cheaper one, which is just a temperature control on it, and just set it to what you think is about right and hope for the best. And,
same as mine,
yeah.
Yes.
And that, you know, that's okay for the casual user that doesn't do it all the time. The better type is thermostatically controlled and actually measures the temperature of the tip of the soldering iron, displays what it is, and you can set it to what you want. So you can set the temperature to be that of melting solder, for example, which is a handy temperature to have. Now, the thing you have to be aware of is when you have the soldering iron sitting on the stand and you set the temperature to what you want and it comes up to temperature and you say, oh, okay, it's up to whatever it is, I should be able to solder something with it. Well, that's not quite the case because the moment you touch the soldering iron to the thing you want to solder, heat leaves the tip of the iron and starts to heat up the wire or whatever you're trying to connect. And that's what you want to have. You want to have the wire hot because until the wire itself gets up to the temperature of melting solder, the solder won't properly flow into the connection. But notice what happens. The heat is leaving the soldering iron, going into the connection. First thing that happens is this, the tip of the soldering iron gets cooler because the heat is spread mm-hmm. out over a wider area.
Of course.
And now that the thermostat asks the controller to send more power to the iron, and the iron heats up more, and eventually everything comes up to the right temperature. But during that interval in between, nothing is at the right temperature. So you have to get everything up to temperature, and the amount of time it takes for that to happen is a function of how much power the iron can deliver. So just be aware of that. So if you try to heat up a single pair of wires, it takes almost no time for that to come up to temperature and heat up. But if you're trying to heat up something of a larger structure, or if you make the mistake of holding that wire with a pair of metal pliers, the soldering iron has to heat up the whole pliers before everything gets up to temperature.
You bet. Yes.
So you don't want to do that. So you want to make sure you're not adding to the time delay. And during that whole time that the thing is coming up to temperature, be aware the component itself is being heated up, and some components can fail before you get up to the temperature where you have to solder it. So you need to have things happen quickly so that the place where the solder goes gets up to temperature and can get soldered before the device gets over temperature and fails. So very, you know, it's kind of a balancing act to do with the power and so forth.
I have another topic I wanted to address about soldering. But before we do, let's hear from DX Engineering,
okay.
and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. You know, it occurred to me that among our listeners, literally thousands of listeners, there are probably some people who have never soldered before. Can you give a quick description of the quote-unquote proper way to solder?
Well, I can try. I guess the first thing you need is you need a soldering iron. You need to be able to have the things you're soldering secure so they can't move during the soldering process. And that works best if and they can move, but they can't move with respect to each other. So best to twist wires together or wrap them around a terminal so they'll stay put. And then you heat up the device to be soldered. And once it's hot and hot enough so the solder flows when you hit the wire, not the tip of the iron, but when you hit the wire, the solder flows smoothly across the connection.
So you apply the solder to the thing being soldered, not to the iron.
Exactly right.
As some do.
Yeah. Now, you want to, before you start, you actually do put a little solder on the iron and wipe it clear, get most of it off, and that'll help transfer the heat to the connection. But it's very important that the solder be applied to the connection point, not to the iron, to make the connection work. Otherwise, you end up with a blob of solder on the iron. You may be able to have it stick or sort of hang on the connection, but it doesn't really make contact. It has to flow smoothly. And once it does, you remove the heat, make sure the connection does not move until it cools. If it moves, it gets a funny crystalline look, and it will not be a good connection.
Kind of a dull appearance, yeah.
Should be shiny.
Is that the proverbial cold solder joint at that point?
Oh, that's a cold solder joint, yeah.
That's a cold solder, okay. Yeah. Better tell them what a cold solder joint is.
Cold solder joint is one that looks like it might have been soldered, but it actually, the solder has not flowed between the two pieces being soldered. So there's no real good connection. It just looks like there's solder on there somehow. I mean, it's like dropping a blob of solder on something. Now, speaking of dropping a blob of solder, there's some rules of thumb here. One, never pick up the soldering iron by the wrong end.
Yes.
We've all done that once, hopefully only once.
I've done it once.
Yeah.
Yes.
The other thing is, if you're working at your workbench, and especially if you're wearing shorts, do not put your limbs under where you're soldering.
No.
Because the solder will not actually make a good connection to your leg, but it will feel like it's really settled in there. you can peel it off after it cools, but it's much better to not have it land on your leg.
You can add to your collection of scars.
Yes.
Yes.
I get the same kind of, just showing Steve, I get the same kind of thing if you're working
on my... Oh, yeah, I got them on my hands and,
Working on my boat's diesel engine while it's hot. Same kind of thing. Doing that last week. Anyway, so that's the key elements to solder.
And should you, I know I do this, wipe off the tip each time?
I generally do it. Now, used to be, I don't know if they still do this, there used to be a little sponge in the...
there is in mine.
Yeah. Keep it wet, and what you do is it kind of cools it off, wipes off the... You get some grunge on the end of the tip after a while from it being hot. Apply some more solder and wipe it, and then the tip is said to be tinned.
That's right.
And it'll conduct heat nicely into the connection. And there you go.
But what if you mess up? I'm making the transition now to the topic of unsoldering.
Unsoldering, yes.
Which is the bane of every amateur radio operator who's ever lived.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, the problem is, if it's a single connection kind of thing, you know, two wires together, if you heat it up, you can, once the solder melts, you can unwrap them or whatever and take them apart. No problem. The problem comes in when you're soldering. You've soldered something with multiple connections, such as an integrated circuit with perhaps 16 pins or something. Now, when you're soldering them, you solder them one at a time, no problem. If you want to remove the component, the trick is you have to unsolder all 16 to get the component to move. That can be very tricky. Now, I guess if the component is damaged and you don't need to save it, you can clip off the pins and you might be able to get it, you know, work your way around and slowly get it off one at a time. But it's very laborious and you may damage the board. The better way to do it is to, there are two ways, two things to do about it. One is to remove as much of the solder as you can. And there are two ways to do that. Well, actually, there's three ways. The one way is you heat up a connection and you whack the board against the table and the solder will fall off or fly off.
Hopefully not on you.
Hopefully not on you. And hopefully you don't do this on the dining room table. You do it someplace where it's not going to be damaged. And a lot of the solder can be removed that way. Now, you try not to break anything when you do that. Perhaps a more elegant way is to use one of the two kinds of devices that I'm aware of that can remove solder. One is called a solder sucker. Mm-hmm. And it basically applies a vacuum to the solder joint. Once you heat it up, you apply the vacuum. and pull the solder out of the connection. There are some that have a rubber ball that does this. There are some that have a spring-loaded.
Mine has a spring-loaded with a trigger. Works pretty well.
Yeah, you have to kind of cock it. And
yes.
Then once the solder is melted, you pull the trigger and it pulls the
That's right.
solder up. And if you get, you know, if you do a good job with that, and what you can do is you can actually put the nozzle of that around the pin so you get all sides of the pin at once, you may be able to find that you've actually removed enough solder so the connection is no longer solid. The other way is to use a thing called a solder wick, which is kind of a braided, looks like a little shield cable kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You heat up the connection and you put the solder wick in there, and the capillary action causes the solder to go up into the wick, and then, you know, it's left the connection. And then you cut off that piece and you have the next piece of the wick and so forth. So if you get the solder off of all the connections separately, if you do a really good job, you'll be able to remove the integrated circuit. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Or you can remove the capacitor or the resistor,
yes,
or whatever.
Yeah, the multi-terminal devices. And the more terminals, the harder it is to get them all done. The other thing you can do is there are devices that actually go on the end of a soldering iron, or sometimes they have their own soldering iron, that are designed to actually make contact with all the pins. Now, typically you have to have one for each size device that you're dealing with. A 16-pin dual inline package device would be different than one with a 64-pin, for example. You put that on all the pins at once, and if you're very lucky, you unsolder it and the device comes out. And that's much easier to do if you've already gone through the steps we talked about before of removing the solder, and there's a little bit of solder left. This will usually do the trick. So even if you're going to use one of these, I recommend getting rid of the solder first as much as you can with one of these devices.
Excellent. Are you ready for a question at this point?
I could do that.
Okay. Well, I think we got one handy here.
Oh, good.
Well, this question comes from Chris, N6ITE, and he asks, I've never had a radio die on me. Knock on wood. One thing that is always mentioned is the finals going out or replacing the finals. Exactly what are these? I've yet to build my own transceiver, so I'm not familiar with all the parts yet. So this is a good question from a new ham's point of view.
I would think so. And what finals refer to is the final amplifier stages of a transmitter. Now, and this is a term that goes back to the early transmitters, but it still applies today. The typical early transmitter just contained multiple stages. It had an oscillator that generated the signal and the frequency you wanted to transmit on, and then you had multiple amplifier stages following that to get the signal level up to a high enough level to properly drive the last amplifier stage in the transmitter. And the last amplifier stage was called the final amplifier. Typically, this is the highest powered part of the transmitter. Mm-hmm. And that makes it bigger, and it makes it more expensive.
Yes.
And it also is the place where the signal leaves that and goes into the antenna system. So it's subject to all the stress of having an antenna that's mistuned and not properly tuned. And consequently, the final amplifier stages are the most likely place to have a failure because either you didn't tune the amplifier or tune the antenna properly. The antenna fell down in the middle of your transmission and it no longer has the proper load and the amplifier draws too much current or something, or you cranked up the power too high, higher than it was supposed to be, or you tuned the antenna tuner wrong. Any of those things can put additional stress on the final amplifier, and that consumes a large part of the power of the transmitter. So if something goes, it can go very loud and it can go very
spectacularly.
Yes, fireworks of all sorts.
My rule of thumb is if I pop open the chassis of a transceiver, I can usually count on finding the finals by looking for where the heat sink is.
Yes.
Because they need to dissipate heat.
That's right. The final, no amplifier is 100% efficient, and typically a linear amplifier in the output stage of a solid-state transceiver is probably at most 60% efficient. So if you have a 100-watt transceiver, that stage has to dissipate 40 watts of power when it's full on. So you've got to have a kind of a warm place there.
Yes.
And if you don't get the power out away from the amplifier, you will destroy the finals. Now, in a modern SSB transmitter, it's not quite the same signal chain that we had before. Now that the signal is not generated at the transmit frequency, it's generated at some other frequency where the modulation is applied, and then it's heterodyned to the right frequency and so forth. But you always end up with a final amplifier as the last stage before the antenna.
That's right.
And they're often the most expensive and the most likely to fail.
Well, that's perfect, Joel. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.